This is Too Political, the podcast in which two old friends talk about politics, the news, and whatever else we think of. My name's Arthur.
And this is Jason.
And together we're
Too Political.
Hi again, and welcome to Too Political, episode 4. Yes, next thing you know, it'll be 5.
Wow. We could do a Sesame Street episode.
5, 5, let's sing a song of 5. How many is 5? Anyway.
Or not.
Or not. Mm-hmm. There are, of course, things to talk about this week as every other week. And today we are going to talk about the President Obama's first overseas tour.
Yes, the big tour. We won't mention the rainbow tour because that would be wrong. We wouldn't want to mention the reference to Evita.
Yes, because that's the...
Because that would be wrong, so we're not going to do that. So I'm sorry, I interrupted you. Go ahead.
That was the first thing I thought of when I heard about it, partly because one of the mainstream media sources was saying that it was an unqualified success, and that just made me think of...
Let's hear it for the Rainbow Tour. It's been an incredible success.
It's been an incredible success, yes. Anyway, where were we? Oh, we're going to talk about that. And the auto industry bailout or lack thereof.
And, of course, we also have comments today, including one that I forgot last time. Me bad.
Oh, and I have, of course, my special days.
Yes.
And I have two really good special days.
Woohoo!
One that I was quite surprised at and one that's just, you know, kind of totally strange and unusual. So should we start with my strange days? Ooh, we could write a book or a movie. Okay. Well... Monday, April 6th, is the 100th anniversary of the discovery of the North Pole, 1909. So, pretty amazing there. And to all of our listeners in Trinidad and Tobago, we missed you because we didn't, of course, podcast last week. But March 31st was the Spiritual Baptist Shouter Liberation Day in Trinidad and Tobago. And, of course, we will have links on the show notes so everyone can be completely informed about the Spiritual Baptist Shouter Liberation Day. So it involves bells and all sorts of fun things. It's actually sort of interesting.
Yeah, I haven't read about it yet, but the name sounds really funny to me.
Well, yes, it does sound really funny, but it's kind of an interesting it's kind of interesting. It's actually, I'm not going to say it's kind of interesting. It is interesting. So anyway, so those are my two important special days, and now we can discuss other things that might not be as important, but you know. So anyway. I'm done now. You know, I'm finished. My part's over. You know, I said things correctly because, you know, Spiritual Baptist Shouter Liberation Day. You try and say that fast a couple of times.
I'd rather not. It could be a sobriety test, though. If you can't say it, then you're
That's
clearly
drunk.
That's
very true. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Well, be that as it may, and moving on to the clearly less important topics of the day.
Yes. That Obama person.
Yeah. Well, the first thing that did strike me about that, about the whole event, or whatever you want to call it, the whole tour, is that clearly... He has already done a lot of work towards restoring the U.S.'s image overseas. Even if you look at the protests in London around the G20 meeting, they weren't protests that were directed at the U.S. as they always were under Bush. Now they were directed at capitalism, they were directed at bankers, they were directed at other targets, but not the U.S. anymore. So there's clearly been a huge shift in European attitudes towards the U.S., which has got to be a good thing overall.
Yeah, I would totally agree with that.
I mean, a lot of the European nations are already committing to more, I don't want to say troops necessarily, because it may not turn out that way, but more assistance for Afghanistan. And I can't imagine that George Bush would have been able to get that.
No. I mean, there's no question about that. It's very interesting. It's... much more multilateral instead of bilateral. That's what a couple of people said. And some of the guys said, well, you know, he's community organizing here. You know, like he had this thing between Sarkozy and the president of China on, it was something to do with people hiding their assets or banking regulations and rules. And I guess he sort of got them to you know, he hauled one off into one corner of the room, and then went over and talked to the other one, and they came to an agreeable compromise, and I think that was a, you know, very important moment for him.
Yeah.
And of course, I mean, his last stop was in Turkey, you know, where he addressed their parliament, I guess. Their parliament. Mm. And, you know, so I thought that was, and he made a point that this was a purposeful, that this was done on purpose, that this was the last stop for a reason. So I think he's done, I think, well, as can be expected in sort of the situations that we find ourselves in at this juncture with, you know, the economy being what it is.
Yeah, and clearly,
economies, or I guess it would be plural, wouldn't it?
Yeah. Well, and clearly that was the main focus and main purpose of the trip, in the sense that the G20 was leading it all off. Now, there are a lot of details about the whole G20 thing that's probably a subject in itself, and not, frankly, I don't know that I understand it well enough to even have an opinion on a lot of what happened. On the domestic side in the U.S., I certainly do, but the international thing is really complicated, and it's funny to me. One of the things, and this actually relates back to U.S. domestic politics, was that that horrible Republican congresswoman from Minnesota called for an armed insurrection against the government, and Obama in particular, because, she said, he was going to lead the world to a one-world currency, despite the fact that I think it was that same day he had said absolutely not, the U.S. was not going to consider a new international currency to replace the dollar like China and Russia want.
Right. He said that in his press conference.
Yeah. Well, no one has ever accused that congresswoman of having any brain cells, as shown obviously by that.
Oh, but, is this the same one who got in trouble last fall?
She got in trouble for saying that Obama was un-American, and then she got derided, and justly so, for saying about Michael Steele, "You demand," at the conservative conference or whatever the hell it was called.
Oh,
so
yeah,
she's crazy. She's all kinds of crazy. But anyway, back to Europe.
Reality.
Back to reality. In the real world, even his interaction with NATO leaders seemed to have gone quite well. But basically, the thing that I took from it was going back to what I said at the beginning, and that's that it was obvious that there was a much more positive view towards the U.S. now than there was under the previous occupant of the White House.
Oh yeah, I totally would agree with that. There is sort of this residual, which I think he sort of addressed. You know, we've changed; you have to change as well.
Yeah.
You know what he said about the Europeans changing, and there was, which I always find sort of interesting, is this thing about, oh well, you know, here's sort of what they hope to accomplish, and it's, you know, it's like a day. And it's more, I think, touchy-feely than anything else. Then, I mean, there were some very positive things that came out of it, but would probably have been done without the high-level meeting. But, you know, it's something that's necessary. And, you know, new president, and everybody sort of wants to shake hands, which I think went that very well. The fact that he's going to Russia in June or July, and then sometime in the fall he's going to go to China. I think those are all very positive things, you know. And part of, you know, the important things that you do with these things is that you do meet people and you size them up, and the more interaction you can have, the you know, sort of the better. I think at least the more possibilities, I think, open up. Whereas, you know, if you keep people at arm's length, it's just so much easier to, you know, to demonize them. So,
yeah, and he had signaled his intentions well before Inauguration Day, even, that he was going to be leading a more outward-looking administration, one that engaged with the international community rather than disrespected them and treated them like children, basically, and that we in the mighty U.S. know what's best and can rule the world by ourselves. I mean, it's not really a partisan issue as such that, I mean, I think people ought to be able to look at the world today and say there's no way that the U.S. can impose its will on the entire world. The U.S. doesn't have that kind of money, for one thing.
Well, it's entirely different. It's not 50 years ago. It's not after the ending of the Second World War, where essentially we could have, and we sort of did to a certain extent. I also think that it's his recognition of that there are grays in the world. You know, with Bush, the axis of evil, you're either with us or you're against us. And it's not that simple. I mean, you know, we even under the Bush administration, they talked to the Syrians and they had back channel talks with the Iranians. So there's got to be some amount of realism in how you're dealing with people.
Yeah.
You know, there's the now, I guess, maybe. There's movement on Cuba. They're going to finally move towards liberalizing travel. And I think hopefully in the not too distant future, there will be a normalization of relations. I've always said that we could have done this 20 years ago and Fidel Castro would have fallen from power so quickly because, you know, businesses would have just swooped down there and it would have become the 51st state, you know, in sort of name, if not in complete and total fact. And this has just been a total stupid thing to do for all the years that we've done it. But it's, you know, politics.
Yeah, it solved no purpose apart from U.S. domestic politics, ultimately. I mean, history has shown us that the policies of engagement tend to produce better results than trying to isolate countries. Although there are plenty of countries that are still kept in isolation by the U.S., like North Korea, for instance, which, of course, was just in the news this week.
Well, I'm not sure if you – I'm not sure – talk about somebody from an alternate parallel universe. I'm not sure. I think in general that's true, but I think – I'm sorry. He's a nut. He's just
absolutely.
You know, it's just a total complete nut. And – I don't know. I think with Castro, you could have had, and I guess Raul's now running the show, you could have a somewhat normal conversation, you know, even 20 years ago, you could have done this. This guy, I think he's just a nut.
Hmm.
Or he plays one very well on television. But I don't, they're so, so closed, so completely and totally paranoid. I don't know how you rationally deal with somebody like that.
Well, I don't think
we sort of tried both approaches, and it's never seen. Nothing really seems to work.
Well, even the sponsor states that have backed them over the years, especially the old Soviet Union and China, had no control over North Korea.
Right. Yeah, that's very true.
And to this day, they don't pay any attention to their supposed allies. They just do whatever they want to do. And so until he dies, I don't think there's even the hope that anything can, there can be any sensible resolution of this whole crisis. And the bigger problem with that, I mean, a lot, especially on the right, they worry about the U.S. being hit with a nuclear missile from North Korea. And that is a fairly remote possibility, but it is a possibility.
Right.
The bigger issue that I can see is the humanitarian one. How many more years do those millions of people have to suffer at the hands of a brutal, insane dictator?
Obama's going to have to deal with this guy, and it almost seems to me that the best way to describe him is like he's like a 5-year-old, and when people stop paying attention to him, he throws a temper tantrum, only this time he's launching a missile instead of, you know, falling on the ground, kicking and screaming. But it's very much like, oh, I want to be paid attention to.
Yeah. Well, of course, the main thing that at this stage is still taking the president's attention is the economy and the current global economic turmoil. And that was, as we were saying, why he was going to Europe for the G20 meeting and so on. He wanted to push the other members of the G20, the other G20 nations, rather, to do more stimulus spending, similar to the U.S. and Britain have done. Germany and France in particular were adamantly opposed to that, and they just wanted better regulation. That their positioning, as I understand it, was that they said that there had to first be a complete repair of the international banking system, reinstate regulation, for instance, before you could even talk about stimulus, because the banks had to be functioning properly, or the whole economic system.
And it also sounded like, at least from sort of what I read and heard on the news, was that they were talking about international type regulations. And they also, at least I believe the Germans said that a lot of the stimulus that we're doing is stuff that they do within their, you know, their setup of their social safety net. That stuff is already present to a certain degree.
Yeah.
But I guess Germany is the main exporter in Europe, and nobody's going to be buying their stuff, even if they're doing the social service or safety net type stuff. They might need to have a stimulus package to help people through.
Hmm. Well, a lot of this will kind of depend, I suppose, on what happens with the banking industry over the next few months or so. But what is in the U.S. certainly is getting most of the attention now is what's going to happen with the auto industry. It wasn't so very long ago that they were saying the big three, if you want to call them that anymore, automakers were too big to fail. They couldn't be allowed to fail. And now they're talking quite openly about allowing them to fail. I mean, mm-hmm. the government has basically said to Chrysler, get yourself merged and be done with it. And, of course, they fired the head of GM.
Well, I guess the question about Chrysler is if Daimler-Benz couldn't do it, why should Fiat be able to do it? Although maybe they've positioned themselves in a different time frame. There's a big, you know, sort of reaction of, I guess Wagner was his name, is the head of GM, that he was sort of like a political sacrifice and blah, 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 blah. And that it just seems to me that they just have taken too long to react. It almost seems to me, and I don't have any, you know, this is just sort of my personal feeling, that they never really wanted to make fuel-efficient cars. They wanted to be able to make a lot of money on their SUVs, because it's just, you know, Toyota reacted with the Prius, and then there's the Camry Hybrid, and Honda has a Civic. Well, next year, the Chevy Volt's going to come along, and you're just like, why did it take you guys so long to do this? And, and it takes, you know, such a long, long cycle and blah, 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 blah. And it seems to me every time gas spiked, they seem to get the price of gas spiked. They seem to get interested in this stuff. And it seems to me once it went back down, they kind of said, okay, we'll put it on hold. And I think the 1-2 punch of the, you know, a year ago, we were starting, just about to start our huge ride up to over $4 a gallon. That, and now this economic downturn, I think has permanently changed the way in which people drive in this country.
It probably has. And certainly the sorts of choices they make for cars, too, have been affected.
Right.
But here's the thing. I think most people could reasonably agree that the American auto manufacturers have been run by incompetent boobs more often than not. Executives have just been absolutely incompetent, because if they had any sense, they wouldn't have made all the series of really colossally stupid decisions that they've made over and over and over again. But one of the questions that keeps coming up is, irrespective of the fact that those companies are run by incompetent boobs who shouldn't be allowed to run a corner store, let alone a big corporation like that, does the government have the right to step in and fire the head of a company? Now, my argument has always been that with respect to firing the GM guy, that of course the government has the right to do it. It's no different than a major institutional shareholder saying to the board, you fire him. We own your company, basically, or a large chunk of your company, and we demand that you get rid of him. What's the difference? I don't see any personally, but a lot of people are really upset.
The FDIC, when it goes in and takes banks over, banks that are failed, that's exactly what they do. And if you know, it would be one thing if they came along and fired the president of Ford, then you would say, I'm sorry, you've completely overstepped your bounds because Ford isn't taking any money. But if Chrysler and GM, here's our plan. We want money. And I think they have the right to be able to come along and say, they're saying to Chrysler, you got 30 days or you're toast. I'm wondering who's going to be servicing my car in the future, but that's neither here nor there. And the same way with GM. So I think you do have, you know, the right to come along and say, we're going to, you know, fire the head of the company. Here's your time frame in which you've got, you know, sink or swim. You've got to renegotiate your contracts. The problem that I see with this is not whether or not they can do it, but sort of the I don't know if it's necessarily fairness, but the question has been raised, and actually, Geithner had a couple of interviews where. Are the standards the same for the auto industry as they are for the banking industry? Mm-hmm. And although they've said, oh, yes, that's completely true, I think that's kind of a stretch. I think they really have to be aware of how this is perceived. And this is very tricky for them. You know, it's in states that if you're looking at electoral politics are important for them in order for Obama. I mean, it's a ways away, but to... Yeah. Win re-election, and you know it's.
Well, I think there's a you've touched on a couple of things that I think are really important. First, in the waning days of the Bush regime, when they started doing their little bailouts, little by modern standards, they made a virtue of the point that they weren't taking voting representation on any of the companies that they were bailing out, as if that was a good thing.
Right.
Now, personally, I think that was one of the biggest mistakes that they made in trying to deal with the crisis, because the taxpayer has a right to have a say in what these companies do. Because if we're shelling them out, or you know, if the taxpayer is shelling out these companies, it's no different than a big institution that they are represented on these boards because you know they've got a lot of money invested. Well, why should it be any different from the taxpayers? But the other thing is about the thing of fairness you were talking about. Now, I've mentioned before here on this podcast about why is it that the contracts of people from AIG or any of the big banks are sacred, but the contracts of the auto workers can be shredded without a care in the world. There's a fundamental unfairness in that structure where the big rich capitalists get whatever they want and the working class people get screwed over. If they don't come down harder on Wall Street, ultimately— they're going to risk losing the people who actually vote because there aren't that many rich people in America.
Well, the main difference here in the ability for them to come along and say change the contracts is because the government is willing, I think I'd put that in quotes, to allow the automobile makers to fail. They're not willing to let the banks fail. And there's this sort of, you know, over and over and over again of, you can't allow that because it's too big to fail. You know, and you've said that much more about financial institutions than you've said about the car companies.
Yeah.
That's receded. I think the repercussions, for the cars, the automobile industry is huge because of the, it's not GM, it's, you know, who makes the parts for GM and then who helps to make the parts for the people who make the parts for GM and, you know, who moves the parts, you know, around. Is it by truck or rail or plane? And it's just, it has a huge cascade across the entire country. And it is, you know, the thing that I always talk about is you don't really have any notion of how this ripples across the country. And you'd also and there are also all these automobile dealerships, which people are talking about, there's too many of them and they're going to have to close down. And what they do within the communities, you know, it's they sponsor, you know, Little League and soccer and softball and all those things that are not, you know, it's, in their interest to have, you know, little Billy wearing the T-shirt with, you know, Oarsman Dodge on it because they're, you know, here's their captive audience, here are the parents, but there's all this stuff that they do and what's going to happen to that and how does that play out psychologically across the board, you know. And you know, I think that the example is, you know, like, you know, here's, you know, your next door neighbor, and is Billy playing, you know, Little League? Oh no, you know, the car dealership isn't sponsoring it anymore, and we can't afford, you know, to send him, and you know, and then I talk, you know, talk to my dad or my brother or a friend somewhere and say, oh yeah, you know, and the people who I know next door, their kid isn't being able to go, and then they might mention it to somebody, and so this has a repercussion beyond just sort of the nuts and bolts of you know, the dollars and cents of it. And a lot of this is all psychological. And usually, in most cases, it's not the really big things that sort of set people off. It's the small little thing, or maybe it's a bunch of these little things. And, you know, somebody could have some conversation and, you know, through friends of a friend's, you know, maybe somebody's in California, but the friends of a friend's are in New York, and they may go, oh, well, you know, and how is everybody's perception changed when something that seems small and insignificant, and you go, oh, wow, that's really bad.
Well, yeah, and that gets back to that whole concept of fairness and equity, because if people are seeing that their local softball, their local Little League team is gone because the car dealer's gone, and yet they see the big banks still paying out multi-million dollar bonuses to executives who don't deserve it, then they're going to see a fundamental unfairness in that. I mean, the Obama administration has already gotten criticism for Geithner because of his Wall Street background, saying, oh, he's going to favor Wall Street. Well, that obviously is something we can't know yet, not until all the dust has settled, all the regulations are in place, or existing ones are enforced, you know, all those kinds of things. But it is a potential problem for them, I think, long term, in making sure that they deal with other aspects of the economy fairly relative to Wall Street. And it may actually mean that they have to be harder on Wall Street in the months ahead, I think.
Well, also the thing is that this, you know, I think you can, you know, sort of question, it is appropriate to question their ties, but it kind of seems to me that in all likelihood, you need people who are at least familiar with Wall Street in order to, help solve the problem. I consider myself to be pretty smart, but I don't think they should tap me for the position, because probably I'm not qualified. So this is it rings a little hollow to me. Some of it is politics, but I think you can then point out is, do they continue to have ties with these people? Are they, you know, what are their interactions? I think that's sort of legitimate, but who else would you pick than somebody who's been on Wall Street?
And ultimately what matters the most is the results they produce, not so much who they were or who they knew or what have you.
Right.
And we're not far enough along in this yet to find out ultimately what the results are going to be. I mean, there is some indication that the U.S. housing market is starting to rebound a bit, but people are still afraid to spend things because they're still afraid they're going to lose their jobs. They're afraid that of all kinds of different things. And, I mean, you touched on the psychological side of it. That is something that is probably among the hardest things for any government to deal with,
right?
Get people to part with some of their money for, you know, goods and services that might actually get the economy moving again.
Well, I mean, the president sometimes has to be the cheerleader in chief, and we had a cheerleader in chief that when it wasn't rooted in reality. You know, it's like sort of the opening part of the, you know, from the election until right before the inauguration, and then maybe a little bit afterwards, it was not quite exactly the sky is falling, but it came pretty close to it from Obama and the administration, and then they started talking about things that they were going to do. And I think you needed to sort of set the notion that it's not going to be over quick. You know, we had another 600,000 plus people lose their jobs. Unemployment's at 8.5%. Those are numbers that are, of course, that will continue to go up, because that always is it's not a leading indicator, it's a lagging indicator of how things are going.
Yeah.
And I think there is some hope. You know, people are, at least from the standpoint of people are refinancing, which is something I've been saying for a while I'm going to look into, but I really do need to look into it. And if you can, you know, lower your rates, there's a chunk of money
that's another. I was just going to say that's another issue as well, because if the U.S. banking system doesn't get going again, the entire world can't recover. Our equivalent of the discount rate here in New Zealand is at the lowest it's ever been. It's at an historic low. And yet our home mortgage rates are still high, and they've started to go back up again. And the reason is that most all of our banks are Australian-owned. All of them get their money on the international market. Their costs of borrowing are still extremely high, so they can't pass on any savings to their customers. And so because of that, our housing market is still depressed. I mean, I said on my Amrens podcast a while ago that the number of new housing consents given in New Zealand was at the level last seen in 1964. And that's just unheard of. I mean, the country is much bigger and much more developed than it was then. You know, things move forward, but
the housing market here has crashed. Yeah.
Yeah. And so until the U.S. gets its banking house in order, the entire world economy cannot recover. And that is how important it is. I mean, a lot of people in the U.S. get wrapped up in how the home housing market is going and mortgage rates and the retirements and stuff. And that's all important. I'm not discounting that at all. But the issues and the stakes are much bigger than that. It's the entire economic health of the world. And people have got to start thinking globally about these things and realize, I think anyway, they need to realize how important it is that we get this solved and quickly. That's my little speech.
Well, good for you. We applaud you.
Why don't we move on to comments then?
Yeah, I think I'm just going to say really quick, I agree with you, but it's you need to start feeling better where you are to be able to do that.
Yeah.
That's the psychology of it, which, of course, we talked about. But that's – and how do you do that? And we could have a five-hour podcast on that and still not come up with an answer. So we need to move on to comments.
Yeah, good plan. Well, as I said at the beginning, we actually had a comment last time that I forgot to read from Roger Green. It's my fault. And so I'm going to do that one now. Now, this is over at emrenspodcast.com, which is, of course, the original home of this podcast. And Roger said, "No doubt many earmarks are for legitimate items. They are opposed by me because of the process. I want a bill that says it's going to do X, Y, and Z, but it's not the way the game's been played in D.C. Guess I want all the transparency stuff this past election was supposed to be about. Call me an idealist." And we actually touched on that in that episode. This is from episode 2. We actually did talk about how there was a difference between opposing the process and just blanket opposing all earmarks and saying they're all waste or poor, because they're not necessarily. And I think I do tend to agree with Roger on that I'd rather see the system reformed so that there weren't earmarks anymore, rather than just, you know, blanketly saying all earmarks bad, because they're not.
Right.
And also on that same episode, Tom the Ramble Redhead said, "Another great show, and enjoyed the discussion on earmarks. I enjoyed the part about ticket costs for concerts as well." You might remember you talked about the Fleetwood Mac at Alpine Valley. "As I was doing some cleaning and found a ticket stub for my first concert that I went to that was out of state. I went to see Billy Joel in 1984, and the ticket price was $14.50. And if I went to see him today with Elton John, the tickets range from $53 and up." That's inflation.
No, it's not inflation. You couldn't even park for that amount of money, $14.50,
practically
anywhere. It's scary, and we sound really old, don't we? Anyway, next.
And the next comment is on episode 3, and it is again from Roger Green. And he has an excerpt from censusproject.org. He's asking specifically about the plans of the U.S. Census to not count same-sex married couples. And it's a fairly long, and he also has a link there, which you can read for yourself. This is at amrenspodcast.com. But that's the gist of it, that they're not planning on counting same-sex couples who are married, legally married. And they say they can't because the Defense of Marriage Act prevents them from gathering that sort of data. And he asks for our observations on that. And I would say that is an accurate assessment, that the Defense of Marriage Act clearly makes it illegal for the federal government to recognize same-sex relationships, not just marriage, but also civil unions or what have you, any federal purpose.
Right. The thing that is even bigger about this, an issue, is how it's going to be done. Because always it used to be, you know, census takers went out. I mean, I had one of my friends who, at least in one of them, was a census taker. And he sometimes says that he was thankful to get out alive in some of the neighborhoods, but or whether they're going to I don't know enough about it to quote sort of the exact term, but sort of estimate. You know, it's sort of like a sampling of some sort. So that's an even bigger to do that's suddenly become the Republicans versus the Democrats. And so this has, you know, ramifications to doing the census period, and also how they are able to do, you know, census for same-sex couples. But wouldn't it even be for couples that were a man and a woman? Would you be able to even tabulate them under the Defense of Marriage Act?
If they're legally married, you can.
No. But I'm saying if they're living together, how would they be counted?
I don't know, but I imagine it would be similarly to the way that same-sex couples living together, whether they're married or not, would be counted, and that's just as two unrelated adults in the same household.
Right.
I do know that if a same-sex couple has children, the children are considered part of a single-parent household.
Mm-hmm.
Even if both parents have legal custody, or they're, you know, legally the parents, the census will only count one, because if they count both of them, they're recognizing the relationship, which is a violation of the Defense of Marriage Act. And I mean, clearly it was bad legislation when it was drafted, and I don't buy the argument that it prevented a constitutional amendment, because there's no evidence that even in the frenzy of frothing Republicanism that they would have been able to pass a constitutional amendment to ban same-sex marriage. They may have, but I don't want to revisit that. The main point, though, is about the census.
Well, and here's a thing to think about. You have states that recognize same-sex couples as being married, and what then happens there? That's an interesting. That's a lawsuit happening.
Well, the states can do what they want, and the thing of it is that I'm not entirely convinced that the Defense of Marriage Act is illegal or unconstitutional. I mean, I tend to think it probably is, but I'm not sure. I will say, though, that the refusal of any state to recognize a same-sex marriage performed in another state is blatantly unconstitutional. And one day it will get to the Supreme Court, and hopefully when the conservatives have been replaced by more sensible people, it will be struck down, those bans.
Crash. Oh, I'm sorry.
No, I don't wish ill on anyone, even though I disagree with them strongly. But basically, I guess what I'm saying is that it is correct that the census has to ignore legally married same-sex couples. And just can I add in passing that New Zealand has counted same-sex couples for quite a while now. Its census is every 5 years. And there's not been a big drama about it. I mean, some of the older folks who remember the days of repression were really reluctant to identify themselves to the census takers. But I think most people sort of move past that now, especially with civil unions and things in place.
It does seem odd to me, because, I mean, couples, period, not even talking about their sexual orientation, how would they be counted at all?
Yeah, and part of the reason that all this matters is because a lot of priorities for federal spending in particular, but also even state and local spending, is based on census data.
Oh, goodness,
and if the data isn't right, they're going to make bad policy, because they won't understand what it is they're trying to do.
Well,
so that's why all this matters.
But also, I mean, the census allows localities, state, cities, towns to go after federal funding. And if this is wrong, or not done correctly, or families are counted oddly or not counted, what does that do?
Yeah.
Which is again with this sampling thing that they're talking about, and not physically having everybody respond to the actual form, which I always love to do. It's just kind of fun.
Yeah, I've always enjoyed censuses, I have to say.
So.
Yeah. Well, the final comment for today is from our site, twopolitical.com, which is number two, political.com. And it's from Tim Cormo, who says, "I so much enjoyed your discussion on the latest show. I wanted to shout out at times about your discussion about AIG, but oh well. I can only leave a comment. I think the folks at AIG were really dumb to think that the world wouldn't react to their bonuses and that anyone would take a job based on bonuses only. It's crazy. I would never do that because usually the company would find a way of find a way out of paying it. I guess AIG was actually being honest, but go figure. Lessons learned once again. And thank you for that, Tim. I agree.
Yeah.
I wouldn't take a job that was bonus only.
What I don't, I guess, well, I'm not sure if I mentioned it, but I'm having thought about this more and more, is what I don't understand is why someone didn't come along and in AIG and say, we can't do this now. You'll get your bonuses, or we'll pay you something because they're cleaning up the mess, you know, and the bad people are gone. And after they were done, I think I think people would still have been ticked off. But if you could have said, yes, and we've gotten rid of all these toxic assets, this division which caused all this problem is going out of business, these people no longer have jobs, and, you know, to send them on their way, I think people would still have gotten pissed off. But at least you could say, we've removed this. This is gone.
Yeah. Yeah.
So.
Absolutely. Well, those are the comments that we have for the past two episodes, actually, and we obviously welcome comments. I would like to encourage anyone to ring our comment line on 206-426-0527, and of course, it'd be nice if somebody were to call it fairly soon so that Jason doesn't have to, because I'll have to make him do it, you see. If we don't get a call once every 30 days, we lose the number.
Oh, so, what was that number again? Let me write it down.
The number is 206-426-0527. And, of course, that will be in the show notes as well. And the show notes are located at our site, which is twopolitical.com, the number twopolitical.com, and, of course, at my own podcast site still. And you can send an email to me at Arthur, A-R-T-H-U-R, at twopolitical.com, or Jason at twopolitical.com. And, of course, there's that phone number again, which is 206-426-0527.
Call right now. Call right now. Operators. That's 206-426-0527. Call in the next 15. Okay, I'll stop.
Call in the next 15 minutes and nothing will happen.
Yes.
Except that we won't have to call.
Yes. Thank you. And you can find me at jasonsviewfromdc.blogspot.com. I have some beautiful pictures of the cherry blossoms. We're in full peak on Saturday when a friend and I walked around the tidal basin. We were practically blown into the tidal basin because there were practically hurricane force winds, but it was absolutely gorgeous and spectacular. And I sort of, as I commented on my blog, I probably have more pictures. The two things I have the most pictures of Washington are cherry blossoms and the Washington Monument. And in one of the posts, I combined both. It was just an absolutely spectacular day, and now winter's coming back, so I'm a little annoyed. But got to see him, so that's always a great enjoyable thing. It's one of the reasons why I love living in Washington, D.C.
Oh, very good. And, of course, I have a blog at amrins.blogspot.com, where I write about all kinds of things. Just passed my thousandth post.
Yay!
Congratulations. That's a hard one to say, thousandth. Thank you. And my personal journal podcast is at amrinspodcast.com.
Well, you just had an anniversary, too. Or a milestone. A milestone.
Well, both, actually.
Oh, that's right.
My second anniversary and my 150th episode. And sort of a programming note, because most people are still getting this podcast through that feed. I originally planned on doing a podcast about Auckland yet this week, and I am going to be recording it this week, but I'm not going to be posting it until after Easter. Because I suddenly remembered any time I post an episode too close to a holiday, nobody downloads it. So I might as well wait.
That's true. That sounds good, like a very good idea.
I think so.
Well, that wraps it up from Washington, D.C. So this is
Jason
saying goodbye.
Bye.
Bye.